Between the theatre stage and stadiums, our guest has sold millions of records as lead singer of one of the most successful contemporary gospel groups in history, Trinity 5-7. Starred as Tina Turner in the hit West End show Tina, and more recently has been going toe-to-toe on tour with Mick Jagger and the Rolling Stones. But these are the headlines, and it's the in-between that we're going to dive into, understanding her journey, her process, and what it takes to keep on keeping on in an industry that's as challenging as ever. This episode, we're getting notes from Chanel Haynes. Let's do it. So here we are.
Here we are.
We are finally here. And it took some getting here. Thank you very, very much for schlepping up from London on a week, by the way, when the tubes are on strike, typically helpful. How are you doing?
I'm great. Very happy to be here with you, Shep.
I'm very happy that you're here. And you are the first. You are opening not just the series, but the podcast, numero uno. So I might be a little bit rusty. That's also why I've picked you to look after me a little bit. It's a while since I've done this, but I think we'll be okay.
We'll be rusty together.
I like
there
that.
There we go.
I like to kick off with kind of common ground. So maybe thinking about how we first connected and also the coincidence of today, actually, and a little favor you did for me 3 years ago. So I first came across Chanel when we came to see Tina on the West End. And it was breathtaking, really. We're going to talk about that role and your relationship with Tina shortly. But we connected after that performance. And can I say we became friends?
It's the truth.
I'm just checking. I didn't want you know, like acquaintance zone me or whatever it is. We became friends and we started to talk a little bit. And it's been really cool getting to know you since then. But 3 years ago, you did me a really cool favor where on the day of my wedding to the day, you recorded one of my wife's favorite songs in a little personal message. Can you remember what song it was?
We just talked about this. I don't know. Tell me.
It was Tonight. So we love the Bowie, Tina. Bowie was number one the day I was born. So I've got a Bowie connection. But you recorded a beautiful rendition of that and dedication.
It was really, you said I did a favor. It wasn't a favor. I was celebrating a love. I was celebrating the spontaneity just all around, like how we met, the organic, natural way that we did. And I just, that's sort of my way. Is I wanted to celebrate and honor your sweet love. You know, you found each other and I wanted to.
Well, you certainly did that. And listen, I'm not going to spend the whole time mentioning my wife as much as she'd love it. But she commented last night on how kind of serendipitous that
and
was
that
in the connection.
Today.
That is today. So she was, we're both very grateful and happy about that. There's so much to cover with you today, and we're going to try and kind of fit it into a reasonable amount of time. We've got a loose structure, but I think things are just going to flow and we're going to cover a few topics. But I thought a good place to start with thinking about people's journey and people's process is your kind of musical roots and early inspirations, perhaps even more specifically, when you realized that performing was going to be a career for you, or that looked like a possibility?
I was 6 years old when I sang my first solo. It was the Christmas play for my school. And my teacher told my mom, you know, prepare her to sing O Little Town of Bethlehem. And I remember that. And I was an angel. And I sort of, it's kind of vague, but I do remember there being a little bit of a fuss around it, like this was more than we expected. And then at our church, the pastor of our church had heard about it, and he said, I think we should have her to sing on, you know, on Sunday, on the special day. And that was my first, I think in my mind, my first official solo. And I remember someone getting a chair, because I was too small behind the podium. And I sit on the chair and my mom was just to my left. And the title of the song was "He Touched Me and Made Me Whole." And so it's a song most, like, you know, you should have gone through a lot in life to talk about how you've gone through this and that, and then the Lord touched you and made you whole. But that was a song that I sang. And I just remember that at the end, there were all these people standing with smiles on their faces, and they were clapping, and there was so much joy and this element of, I don't know, it was just... I just remember feeling like this tingly. And I looked at my mom and I said, "I like this." And I think that's when I knew. I said, I want to be a singer. And from that moment on, that's all I've ever done. I don't think anyone would hire me to do anything else. I've never had a job. They'd fire me and say, "You don't know how to do this?" I've never done anything but perfect my craft and do what I know that I was born to do. And so here we are.
Here we are indeed. So, I mean, well, I guess progressing from that moment then, as you kind of, from being 6-year-old, what were the kind of next milestone moments on that journey?
I think the next biggest one would have been Quincy Jones coming to New Orleans. He was working on a TV show for kids, specifically looking for the most talented kids of New Orleans. And I remember there were about 1,200 children wrapped around the building. I don't know why I know that number, but it was about 1,200. And 7 was chosen. I was one of the 7. And we did a pilot. It was called Big Time TV. Wherever that footage is, I'd love to see it. I don't know who has it, but...
Oh, we can put a shout out. Big Time TV.
It was called Big Time
Quincy
TV.
Quincy Jones. All right.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know that it ever, you know, took off. It didn't. It was just like a project that he worked on. But what was special about it was when we were all done taping and we'd done everything, of the 7 of us, he said, 3 of these kids are extraordinary. And I remember one girl name was Amber. And he said, he told the producers, take her footage and send it to the Apollo, because I think that's like the market for her. And then the other boy was Trombone Shorty. Look him up.
Trombone Shorty.
He was this kid who was like, you know, sort of like the Louis Armstrong, but with the trombone. I mean, he's this massive Grammy Award winning, incredible artist. And then there's this little girl, Chanel, and Quincy said, and take her footage to Star Search. And that was my first national appearance. I was on Star Search.
Like, and what age are you at this moment?
About 16, I think. About
16
years old.
So where are we talking then? So we're mid-90s, are we?
Yeah, like around 96-ish or 95-ish. But see, there's people who's going to try to calculate my age. So we're going to say in the 90s.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, we keep it vague. Don't you worry. But like, I mean, at the age of 16, you would have had an appreciation for who Quincy Jones was.
Yes, yeah. So it was all these kids, teenagers that, yeah, no, I absolutely understood the, and.
Here's a guy who's obviously, you know, kind of produced mega hit albums, mm-hmm. from Michael Jackson to.
Thriller, like, all of it.
My favorite Sinatra album. He conducts the orchestra for his 50th birthday. Mm-hmm. Such range. Like I also love his book, Notes on Creativity. Mm-hmm. I love. And he picks you out at the age of 16.
And really, to be fair, like Quincy, I can give you a list of, through my teenage years, of other brilliant souls that just saw me. They saw not just the talent, but there's something more. They can tell. They're like, no, this whole thing, we know there's something there in that little girl. Aretha was one of those people. Gladys Knight was one of those people. I can not to name drop, it's just, but I'm saying those names because of all the amazing souls I've met, the way they touched me and how they influenced me in the earliest years of my life, it made me want to care about when there is another younger artist that is in my presence and they want to learn or be exposed to the what I have to offer. I want to be as eloquent and as a beautiful as a soul as they were to me. I want to be that to someone else. So that's my standard. They are my standard.
Well, so, yeah. That's a pretty iconic standard. Can you remember or recall in particular any of the kind of guidance or advice or how they steered you as a younger artist with their experience?
I think with Aretha, I don't know how much I should say, but she invited us to her home. Excuse me. She invited us to her home to sing for her son's wedding. And it was in their backyard. So it is truly just this family gathering. And she's a preacher's daughter like I am. So if you're there, it's because she knows you're going to bring it. You're going to bring that spirit into the performance and everything. So just meeting her standards as a singer and to be invited, not for a stage, but for her most intimate personal is high praise. And at this time, I'm about 19 years old or 20. And, but a lot of people know two things about Aretha. She doesn't travel by plane. She doesn't trust the plane. So it's just the bus or a train or something. And the other thing is when you pay her, it's cash. That's it. There's no, what a cash. So, one of my favorite memory of her is at the wedding. It's time for us to go and meet her in her office. Well, her office is the kitchen. And she's also known for being the best cook ever in life. So we go in the kitchen and I'm just following this light green chiffon dress of the mother of the groom, you know, and we're walking into the kitchen and she has like, it's like a halter, but Aretha is Aretha. And she's walking in there and we follow her and she goes inside and pulls out this gigantic wad of cash. And I felt like the mafia, like it was like some gangster Motown back in the 50s or 60s or something. She's like, we're in the kitchen and I'm paying you. And I just remember I'm mad to this day that I spent the money from the bosom of Aretha Franklin. I didn't know at the time, like how uniquely special that was. But in all of her glory, being the queen of soul, you know, iconic as she was and is and always will be, there was this very down home, down to earth, this is how I do things. Nothing in life, this is how I do them. I don't care for what other people's standards are of how they do business. This is how I do business. And that tiny moment is one of those things for me is you don't have to change your way of how you take care of business because the things around you have, that's constant change, constant. And a lot of times it works, sometimes it don't. It has nothing to do with me and how I do business. And I learned that from Aretha.
That is, that's a great lesson and a really fascinating insight into, I love a story like that about somebody who is so on a pedestal and iconic that's so human. Like,
yes.
Yeah, I love that. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of age 19. Mm-hmm. How far off are you at this stage? Or is this with Trinity 5-7 now is happening? Yes.
This is the very earliest, the earliest stages of Trinity 5-7. Because what we'd done was we redid one of our singles from our very first album was Oh Mary, Don't You Weep, which was a song that Aretha had done on her one and only sort of gospel album as Aretha Franklin.
Sure.
So I think there was even a film all about the Amazing Grace, you know, that she'd done, and Mick Jagger, everybody was there. They wanted to witness her in her father's church, you know, singing the gospel with the choir. And anyway, we'd covered that song, and that was part of what made her interested in us, because she's like, yeah, that's how you do it, you know. So yeah, that was around the same time. Because I remember we signed our contract, my first recording contract. Yeah, I was 19.
And Trinity 5-7 was a group that was assembled. I think you knew one of the co-artists kind of already, but how did that kind of come about? What was the process, or how did you?
A short story to it. I am Angel, the soprano of the group, and I'm the like the tenor of the group. We were high school friends in ninth grade. And so I'd already known about this really cool, pretty girl who's like the best voice in the school. But we would always enter talent shows together. And
competing against each other. Yeah, okay.
Because before we were friends, I was like, I see you. And she's like, I see you. And I respected her as a singer, but I'm just going to say I won first place. She came in second. We always tease each other about it. But when we graduated from high school, I and the Quincy Jones thing had started. My manager at the time said, yeah, we got to get you a record deal. We get the best option of a record deal. And they say, you know what? We love her. We think she's extraordinary, but you know what the market needs that they don't have? This young, fresh face for gospel music, three girls that can sing. Like they didn't have that. So almost sort of like a Destiny's Child, but a wholesome good girl version.
So, and for you as an artist individually at that time, was gospel where your head was at? I understand your kind of heritage, but it was, right?
Yes.
So I've been listening to you all morning. I messaged you earlier to say I've been kind of listening to those albums. And what struck me, you mentioned about it kind of being wholesome, but it sounds about as mainstream for that era as I imagine gospel could be. Like it really, there were kind of vibes of, like you say, Destiny's Child, like En Vogue, TLC, little bits of kind of Braxton and Houston. And like, it's a bit funky as well. Like I really enjoyed it. The first album, which I know was like breakthrough, tremendous success, Trinity 5-7, the album I really enjoyed. But then I really enjoyed Spiritual Love. Mm. In particular, Put Your Hands On. Like I listened to a couple of times.
Jeffrey Osborne.
It is like you say, it is wholesome if you really, really listen to it, but it absolutely sounds like the cutting edge of music for that moment, stylistically.
That was the unique approach. It's why the success was so massive, because the content, the actual content, was designed for all these young kids that were in all these churches all over America that didn't have music that they could embrace. It was just always like music for their parents. But then our image and our producers, our writers were all mainstream writers. So whoever wrote for Monica and Brandy at the time, you know, a TLC, all those writers, Mary J. Blige, we had all those writers. And
you can absolutely hear
their influence.
Yeah.
So in the album Spiritual Love, there's the actual title song Spiritual Love. If you really listen to it, you'll hear the formula of Monica, is another massive artist at the time. I think Angel of Mine was her hit, which I think was in like Michael Jordan's big movie where he was the best.
Space Jam.
Space Jam.
Yeah.
Okay. So though they would hand pick and say, okay, because these we had three different voices that we could play any of those sounds. It was really, we did very well. Throughout the 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah, I really, really have enjoyed listening to it over the past day or so. Is there any music, any of those songs that kind of creep into your subconscious or you still regularly catch yourself singing or that you like to sing?
From my Trinity years?
Yeah.
It's really interesting. I've never been asked that before. For some reason, I become very shy around even interviews or talks around my Trinity years because I guess I was so innocent and so naive about so much that I actually physically and mentally and emotionally sort of embody that girl again. And she has different answers and different feelings and everything, so I get shy.
Yeah.
But I will say there is one song that we did towards the very end of our career together. It's called Go. And it was sort of a fundraiser album for our friend whose wife had died of cancer. And it was just all these songs to inspire you. Just go in this particular song. It's like, when I've been through the fire, when I've been through the rain, you know, I hear his voice and just go. And I'm speaking of that song because when many years later, when I was, for example, backstage about to go on as Tina, or I was waiting for that one phone call from Mick to say, are you going to be a part of it? Like it would be these major moments many years after. That's the one Trinity song that I would play that. It's almost like I didn't sing it. It was almost predestined for me. So I listen to it and it tells me, you know what to do. You got this. So that's probably one of my most standout songs.
So it's almost like a meditation or a kind of you center yourself with that. I love that. And I appreciate totally what you mean that as an artist in one time of your life, songs and your kind of craft can mean a very different thing to you than it can, you know, years later. Mm-hmm. When you become so established as a gospel artist, how hard was it for you then to broaden out of that or to kind of get into different types of music? Do you get pigeonholed and people kind of label you as that kind of artist and that's how they think of you? Or can you break that perception? Can you kind of
It very much depends on the person. I do believe that there is a seed planted in your soul or in your heart and your being before you even conscious up here. And your one job is to sort of try to always stay in touch with that. Like, don't completely ignore it to the point that you're now an 80-year-old man or woman and you just freaking ignored that. And it was always holding and waiting to be revealed. So saying that to say there was always something in me that I knew that I wasn't defined by a genre or the expectations of a specific group of people. I always knew that through music, through my voice, I'm here to inspire people, to shine light, to uplift, to encourage. And so in whatever capacity that is, it'll take on that shape, but it's not just going to come from this genre of music or form of entertainment. And so whatever felt organic to me, I trusted it because I wanted to do it because it felt good to me. Even if it made me uncomfortable, that discomfort probably came from expectations of other people. But if I turned that off and said, how do you feel when you sing that song, Chanel? Or how do you feel when you're on that stage versus this stage? And I'm like, wow, I don't have to wear a long dress this time. Because all the, you know, you're doing a good Christian, you know, you're doing a show at a church or, you know, a church conference. As a woman, it's very important what you wear. And it's almost more important than what your song is. Are you presentable? Can we accept you? Because if you don't pass the visual test, we can't receive anything that's coming out of your mouth. That's one way to exist as a performer. But at some point, that doesn't feel good to me. What am I getting out of this?
Sure.
So one day you get invited to sing a song and nobody knows. And you can wear whatever you want because that's not the focus. The focus is, can you bring it? So, you know, it's really just that compass that I've always followed. And wherever I sang, whatever group of people it is, we all leave a little bit better, more inspired. Like, what a night. That's my goal. So it was hard for my dad probably in the beginning. How do you go from gospel to rock and roll? And actually singing some of the lyrics of the Stones, when I got the lyrics for our rehearsals, I would look at them and go, what does this mean? Because there's all these layers of meaning behind their words throughout the decades, you know?
Yeah.
And the funniest part was to see my dad on the front row at the Stone show, and the song is, "Start me up, won't you start me up, I'll never stop." And my dad's like, "This is awesome." And I'm like, oh my God.
The less you know, the better. Listen, we're gonna progress into Tina and Mick shortly.
Oh, yeah,
but
sure.
What I want to ask you about, just to kind of wrap up that early phase, sure, of your career, because I think it's the whole point of what we're doing here is to be useful, hopefully, to a younger you and a younger me and a younger anybody, yes, out there who's trying to pursue similar kinds of careers to yours. What you've spoken about mentors and influences with some great examples. What about management and that kind of guidance? How successful, unsuccessful, ups, downs, and in-betweens, what's that kind of journey been, yeah, like early on in your career? Did you have good people around you or phases, or how would you describe that?
So wonderful question. Obviously, with a career span like mine, I had all the in between, the ideals, the absolute disappointments. And ultimately, I believe that it all served me to be exactly where I am today. I have no regrets about any of those choices, because every time I made the choice, I was doing the best that I could with what I had, with information I had access to. And sometimes you have a manager that has all heart, but they don't necessarily have the tools, or the opposite. They have all the tools, but they don't care at all about how you fare out. They just have their bottom line. In both cases, you benefit. And in both cases, there's a deficit. So, and then there's all everything in between. I happen to finally be in a place where I have a team around me and someone heading my management team that is, I'm very surprised that I've been able to experience this in a management capacity, because basically what it is, it's a mirroring. What I am to what I do, and how trusting I am, how absolutely talented I am. This is not ego. It's a fact. Okay. I know what I'm doing. I'm not proving anything. I'm not in a phase of my life I'm trying to prove to a manager that you should manage me. No. And to find the counterpart of, I see all of who you are, and I see that they're exactly what I need. It's a mirror from a professional standpoint. I didn't know that I would ever actually have that, but I'm very blessed to say that I do.
As in, you didn't believe that it was out there, or that you'd be able to find that?
I haven't had a manager in 20 years. And I just recently said, I'm ready, because it was proven. You know how they say, if you do the work, I don't have to convince people I'm a singer. I sing. You do it, and there's nobody who can do it like you. And when you experience that from someone, they're just managing you. They're just saying, I'll take care of it. You know, there's no big announcement. They're just doing the work without asking anything of you. I can't tell you how many times I've sang for people. There's no audience. There's no press. There's no one saying, it'll be cool if you did this. I sing. That's what I do. And when I see that in another soul, it's natural to you to take care of me.
Do you know, I was thinking a little bit about then, like I really love your confidence, and you are entitled to that confidence, having established yourself as you have. There's a great, you mentioned Quincy Jones earlier on. He talks sometimes about paralysis by analysis, waiting for the perfect moment and putting things off. And I read something recently about good performances don't come from confidence. Confidence comes from good performances. Mm. You have to get out there and do it. Your confidence isn't going to come and knock on your door and then you'll be ready. It's actually going and doing it and keep on doing it. That's where the confidence comes from, which I think a little bit is what you're talking about, is getting out there and doing your thing.
And there is, and as I spoke of the other people, speaking of Quincy and Aretha, Gladys, these are truly some of my greatest influence in that who can stand next to them? Like they're their own, and they're not convincing anyone, I am the great, I am the this. They are who they are. And what I find particularly interesting about them is their attention and care to a young girl who they knew they were influencing me in the moments that they were, that awareness, that consciousness. So, you know, yes, you have to be complete. You have to know who you are. And while you know who you are, there's the other side, that other balance where, and I have a responsibility. First, responsible to being authentic. Responsible to knowing what I need in order to be the best version of myself. When you take care of that, you can take care of the other people around you. And I think that's what they all had in common.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what you're describing is a faith in what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't have that faith in what you're doing, how can you expect anybody else to? And whilst essentially any kind of creative practice is ideally for an audience, mm-hmm. in a way, you kind of have to make it for yourself first, and you have to believe in that. Otherwise, what you're creating is a reaction to what you think people want. And I don't think that's where the best art or creativity comes from. I think you have to believe in what you're doing and hope that at some point other people will see that belief and enjoy what you're doing and buy into it. And then away you go.
I'll tell you this. You have to be even more specific than that. It's not just other people. When you've mastered you, you've mastered your craft, you know who sees you? Other masters. You don't need 10, 20, 30,000 people to see you. You need the ones who cultivated themselves. When a master looks into your eyes, because there's no competition there. They see themselves. Now we're in good company. Oh my God, now we can relax. I'd love to hear more about, tell me about your journey. Because that master, they're sure to discover the similarities. And it's wonderful to have that. So I should say around this, don't seek for massive acceptance. That's not the goal. It's to be seen by who's supposed to see you. Let that be, if anything, more of a focus, because it means that you're not projecting for acceptance. You've done the work, and all you really want at the end of the day is an actual, to see that reflected. And I don't always know how that's gonna come, but whatever comes, it's the real deal. It's the real thing. And when you have that approach, you'll get to your goal much faster. oh, it is a true shortcut. And I know how social media is. I know how it's sort of like all about how many likes and how all that. I'm sorry. It is a way. It's a path. I'm not going to say that it's not. I just think it takes so much more away from your essence and authenticity, and it takes so much time to develop that you have to ask yourself, do I want to spend more time developing that or developing my authenticity and then getting the attention of the A&R of Sony? Because, yeah, they may want to know what your numbers are, and that is a thing. But if you can walk in that room and do something that when they go home, they can't sleep at night, that's not something...
Yeah.
Social media.
No amount of followers can give you that.
They can't give you that.
So this is maybe a nice segue. We're talking a little bit about craft and kind of honing your practice. One of the features that we are going to have on the podcast is Message and a Bottle. And I have down here a bottle of Pinot Grigio, which I believe is your drink of choice. Now, listen, there's nothing like a good bottle of wine. This is nothing like a good bottle of wine, but it's for you.
Okay.
On the basis that you'll just give us your answer to this question. So normally it will be a future guest that will send this bottle and a message. But today, because of the connection, it is in fact my wife, Lauren.
Lauren.
She has sent a question for you. And this is the question. It's kind of to do with your practice and your craft. She says, what are your non-negotiable parts of your daily routine that keep you centered mentally, physically, and spiritually? Non-negotiables. What's in there every day as part of your routine?
Solitude. Yeah. I don't care if it's an hour, 30 minutes, or it's no sound. The only thing I want to hear are my own thoughts. If I go a whole day without that, I just feel like I'm spinning because I'm thinking of, sure. It's always something to do. And of course, having two spirited boys.
The moment you said solitude, I kind of visualized your home life and I thought, interesting, particularly at the back end of the holidays too.
Yeah. You carve it out. That is it's my tiny little gift to myself, because it's very easy to lose yourself with such a demanding, these massive entities. I mean, I always say my family can't be my career. My career can't be my family. Like, my parents back in New Orleans and all my brothers and sisters and cousins. So I have this way that I think of my life. I don't know how this is going to come across, but this is what it is. I am the center of my universe. In my orbit are all the things that I need to keep me balanced, healthy, thriving. Anything in that orbit that is off, it needs some attention, but it has two things that can happen. You can get in line so that we all work in here, or it'll be expelled because it's going to throw everything off. And so if someone says, well, I feel like you're putting your career first, or I feel like you're putting your children before you, no one can be my son to me. No one can be my mother to me. No one can be that microphone, that stage for me. They're all within my orbit. They all make me who I am. And in order to manage all that, a solitude, I'd get to go, and I close my eyes and I can see it all kind of moving around me. I'm like, oh yeah, I'll get with you in a minute. Or, okay, this needs a little bit more of this. But if you don't check it,
you lose the clarity.
Yeah.
And the balance.
Yeah.
I like it. So it's kind of, I heard somebody say, talk in reference to like your significant other. Somebody said, oh, they're my universe. And they said, no. They're a planet in your universe.
There you go.
There are many planets in your universe orbiting around. And I think that clarity is really important. And any of us can lose track of it during busy times or you drift. But I think it's, for me, sometimes it's a blank piece of paper. I kind of just, I need to push reset and just kind of put everything down and kind of circle some things, underline things, maybe put a cross through a few things that aren't, you know. So I like that. And you're clearly comfortable in your own company by yourself.
Oh my gosh. Yes. One of my friends, they said something around the idea that, women don't really like being alone. They like to, I said, what are you talking about? Okay, so no blanket statements around Chanel, because obviously every individual is different and they need what they need to be fulfilled, to feel whole. And, you know, it is no one else's number one priority for you to be happy. I don't care what they tell you. There's no way that your happiness is their number one. They want you to be happy, of course, but it's not even natural. It is your. If you want joy and happiness and fulfillment in this life, that is your job. So that eliminates most people from disappointing me.
Sure. my dad was a fireman, and there's a couple of analogies from his career that I like for life, but one of them is the breathing mask. Like the most important thing is your breathing mask, because if you have a problem with that, you're no use to anybody else. And I think your mental well-being and your mental health,
absolutely,
your happiness is exactly the same thing. You can't find your happiness in somebody else. You have to find it in yourself and then align with somebody else. And for sure you can build together, but
and your loved ones, want the truest ones, they want that for you because they want it for themselves. I always say, because a lot of my girlfriends are like, so you don't mind when your husband goes out and hang out with the guys all night or he does his thing? I'm like, I send him on vacations. I'm like, dude, take 3 days off. Go, dude, you've been holding it down. You know, like you've been cranking. What do you want to do for yourself? Give yourself that space, because guess who else is going to be doing that? Do you understand what I'm saying?
I understand exactly what you're saying.
It's a gift to your partner. You do that for each other. Because especially when you have a family, I think I may have said this to you, is three things. There's you, there's us, there's the family dynamic. All three require, I think, a fair amount of attention. And if you do that for yourself, you'll be fine. It's just when we just,
Well, I think that's a great answer. I think Lauren will enjoy that.
And thanks for the Pinot Grigio.
And you've got the Pinot Grigio. So, all right, listen, we've got into it. It's how I came to know you, Tina. What really struck me when I saw you in that performance, first, as like a lifelong Tina Turner fan, the first kind of bars that we hear you sing, I had kind of goosebumps on the back of my neck. And let me say this, like I don't like a tribute act. Like that's not my scene. I don't like that. And I didn't think that was anything like what I was going to see, but I didn't know how I was going to feel seeing somebody portray this artist that means a lot to a lot of people, but I was particularly a fan of. And I had goosebumps. It felt like she was there and, you know, I was witnessing her in the flesh performing. And yet something that I always think, and I've said this to you before, that struck me about your performance is I also felt you in the performance as well. And there was some kind of great balance between your portrayal of Tina and it also being your portrayal of Tina. So that, I just want to kind of suspend that comment because we'll come back to it in a moment. But how did it happen? How did this opportunity to play Tina in this kind of, it was new to the West End. How did that come to you?
Well, when I was in high school is when the film came out about her life.
Angela Bassett.
Yeah, What's Love Got to Do with It? When I saw the film, it transformed me. And I knew in that moment, I said, if they did a film on her life one day, they're going to do, you know, a show. And when that time comes, I will play Tina Turner. So I was in high school. Fast forward, I've just given birth to my child. And my husband calls me and say, you're not going to believe this. There's a show on Tina Turner. And I felt two things. One, I knew it. And then I have this big belly from just having a baby. And it also means if it's announced, they've already chosen their girl and it's all happening. And I'm already, but I knew that it was moving to New York for Broadway, which meant there will be an opening for that slot in London. And I said, I called a dance studio. I booked my own studio. I started conditioning my body right away. I called all the, you know, started getting my visa. It takes 3 months to get a visa. I started working on that. And I did a deep dive and figured out who is the booking agents of London, who's in charge of the musical. And I found the top 10 agents of the West End. I did all that. And then I found the email of the casting director. I don't know how I did it, but I sent her an email and I did two emails all in bold print to make sure that when she clicked, it would say, show these two subjects. And both of the subjects said, I am your next Tina Turner. And when she clicked it on, I'd already gone into the studio and recorded covered three Tina songs for her. I sent my bio. I sent my awards and accolades and all the things. And I held my breath for days.
What I love about this so far is you've gone from kind of talking about booking the studio, conditioning your body, diving mm-hmm. into her and her material, the show side of things. Mm-hmm. But you've also gone to work on the business
yes,
side of things as
I
well.
I did. Because I know you don't just find out where these auditions are. There was no way I knew how to find them. So I figured, well, these guys must know. So I just found who had, because I told my husband, I said, if I get in that room, wherever that room is in London, it's mine. I just don't know where the room is. So I have to find that room. That's how I, and well, I did.
Kind of segues onto my next question then. You being in the room and you knowing it'd be yours if you got in the room. Clearly, you're an established and talented performer at this point in your career and proven. But why would it be a given in your mind that you were the person to play Tina? What was it that you felt you had to offer or to bring to that role that would make you the right choice?
Her story was so similar and is still to this day so similar to my own. Saying that to say, I am not an actress. That's not why I got the role. I got the role because I channeled all of it. Was when you say you had chills because you saw me and you saw her, you felt the commonality of it. That's what I brought into the room, my raw self. Because, and you know, for example, she's the daughter of a preacher. When I have to go from being that innocent girl into a rock star, that's already my real life. So there are lines in the show that the average girl is acting. She doesn't really know what it means to say that. I know what it means to, for example.
You're drawing on experience.
I'm completely drawing on experience. And so every night I was reliving her feelings and mine for when those same things would happen to me. So I knew that if I got in the room with them, they would detect that the honesty of my approach to it. And they'll also be able to tell, no, she actually did the work. I'm not just asking to coast. I'm not a trained dancer. I'm not a trained actress. I'm not a trained singer. I am Chanel. And if you see it, then everybody in the audience, they'll see it, you know?
Do you know, you said something there that you're not a trained actress, dancer, singer. I know what you mean when you say that in terms of having an external party train you, but you have trained yourself.
Yes.
Yeah, like you. So in my mind, you are trained, but you've been to the school of the school of Chanel. I'm glad that you said that about the commonalities between your life and Tina's, because even to this day, there are some similarities in your kind of, you know, your journey and the things that you're now achieving. So I guess we're in it now, like during this process of becoming Tina, somebody who obviously was already a part of your atmosphere and your world. What did you learn about her through the process that you didn't know before?
I don't have actual, like, direct from her that this was her case, but I'll tell you something very specific. Like, I leave my home to go to work, to go and do a show. But this is the one day that my kids are saying, "Mommy, please, can we come with you?" And I already know that they can't really be backstage. You can't really, really. So there's this transition of going from mom mode to work mode. But to get all the way to the backstage door, and because it is specific, particularly like around COVID times where everybody have to be really careful, your family can't just hang out backstage. And to be, and there's a picture, I'll always treasure it, but I'm sitting on the ground with my baby begging me, "Please, mommy, can I come in?" He doesn't understand why he doesn't have access to continue to spend the rest of the day with me. And then I go on stage with that weight. So imagine, of course, when I'm doing my scenes and my little boy runs up to me, all of those emotions are there. What I learned in that moment was, while I'm experiencing that, there's a line around the building of people that are just excited. They're touching up their lipstick. They're in a completely different state. They want a show and they're going to get it and it's going to blow them away. And while they're thinking and feeling that and knowing that, my heart is in a million pieces. This is the story of Diana Ross, of Tina, Whitney Houston, Beyonce, list goes on and on. And I think that was something I never really, because I was a new mom, you know, in a new country. You know, we did the same thing. We both left LA in our 40s with two boys, came to London to reinvent ourselves. I'd never done theater. I've never been on Broadway or the West End. This is the one show I wanted to do, the only show I'll ever do, because you won't see me doing Mary Poppins. I don't think you would want to see that.
You may not do it. I would want to see it.
No, you wouldn't want to see it.
But you're right. I mean, that at that time, because it's, we're not getting into specifics on ages as we've discussed, but I think probably around the time that you were born, she was probably still in Vegas doing this stuff there. And then she transitioned over to, with her new management, to London to do what you just said, because they got her here.
They got
and
her
they
here.
Saw the opportunity.
Yes.
She, you know, obviously kind of worked with the right producers who saw and gave her that opportunity. So the similarities and I imagine the things that you're able to connect with are plentiful. So that's, I can see how you would learn that about yourself and connect to her and the role. Yeah. Was there anything that you learned about yourself specifically during that experience of portraying somebody night after night? How did your relationship with the role evolve from kind of start to when you left it?
Well, it went from representing Tina on stage to representing Tina off stage, to representing Tina in my contracts, in my interactions with the company, with my cast members. You realize they believe me. And I believe me, I know what it took for me to get here, but they're not seeing me turn that switch off. They're still seeing this, this girl is serious. Like, she's not just the resilient character on stage, but she has standards in her business as well. And where there would be times where people would want to take advantage of me because I didn't really know a lot of, for example, the rules around, you know, theater and like what's normal. And I kind of like that. I love, ignorance is not the worst thing in the world. In my case, I'm forced to see it for what it is. If it's not authentic, if it's not reflecting truth, it's null and void. You lie to me, it's not a big deal. It's just that this isn't happening.
Yeah.
It's not personal. But if a contract is involved, now you have people saying, now we have a problem. And I'm saying, no, there's not really a problem. So I had to learn in real time how to manage myself off stage, securing, creating boundaries that protected my voice, my body, my reputation, and honoring Tina at the same time. Because often I would say in my dressing room, Tina, what would you do? What would you do here? And I really relied on my integrity. I relied on people knew that I was a woman of my word. And yeah, I upset some people, but tell me one person at the top of their game that they did not mess up some people's worlds. That's, it just comes with the territory.
Absolutely.
And it's, sorry.
And I think you, that's what keeps it fresh. That's what keeps you kind of in the moment, like you say, authentic.
Yeah.
And it's a horrible feeling when you're not learning, right? I think as a kind of artist or as a kind of creative, that's kind of the first time you die, really, when you stop learning.
Yeah.
From the show, from the, obviously you kind of know inside out, were the particular favorite moments or numbers that you would really look forward to or that you even miss now or that were favorites?
Yeah, definitely. I think one of my absolute favorites would be We Don't Need Another Hero. It was everything, because it's a culmination of things. She had just sort of become Tina, and she's losing her mother, and she's kind of over Ike. It's this big moment, and it's sort of this place where she finds her inner strength. And yeah, singing that song, and everyone kind of has this light, this lit candle, and they're, so I imagine it when I was doing it. All the lights in her world, all the people that believed in her and built, they all come around and they surround her. And then it's the big, we don't need another. It's so big, but right as it's supposed to be the end of the song, it goes almost back to the beginning of the show. So it's like the end and her beginning. So it goes back to boom, doom, 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 doom. And now I have to sit in this circle surrounded by the lights. Of, you know, and I have to, it's the quickest wardrobe change in the show, because literally right there, the coat comes off and I have to step into my dress, my red leather dress. And it's this actual transformation of going from this heavy, all the things to dress, red leather. And that you come up and it's Tina. Full, ready. That transition was always, because we all experienced that. Like, maybe not all, but whatever was going on in my life, I could take whatever I'm experiencing. And in that moment, I can take it off and put on that new energy, that fresh, that power, that love, that force of nature. And then you go and you do what you were born to do in spite of the coat of all the things. Like, that was my favorite transition.
It's powerfully symbolic, as you describe her kind of shedding.
Yes.
You know, that history. It's also, I always think it's a really clever use of that song as mm-hmm. well, because it's almost very different to like the original context. It kind of takes on a whole different meaning through the staging of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a nice choice. In terms of her as a performer in your preparation, were there any particular performances of hers that you would go back to specifically to kind of watch or that you enjoyed of hers?
Disco Inferno. I watched it so many times before, of course, all of her footage just growing up. So, and The Fire Dress by Bob Mackie. I mean, who doesn't want to wear her clothes, which I am so lucky to have the most amazing Tina Turner fans. I don't even think I call them my Tina tribe because they're the real deal. And they own some of her original costumes. So I've gotten to perform in some of her clothes. And I'm like, it's her DNA. She sweat through this. And now I'm singing and sweating through it. I'm like, yeah, I'm a little psycho fan of Tina myself.
But you, by default, you've become an ambassador kind of for her legacy, I think, in a lot of ways as well. I think people, I remember through talking to you and through your kind of socials, you did kind of take on that a real ambassadorial role for her and then what became her legacy. Like, you were very, I used to love, you'd post a lot of kind of pre-show preparation and ritual. And it was great to have that insight, but you could see how much it meant to you. I think that's the point I'm driving at. It was kind of more than a role. It was a lifestyle and something that you'd inhabited for that period.
It was. We all have these massive dreams, right? Like, oh, I want to be a race car driver. I want to be this or that. I wanted to tell her story properly. And I knew that only going through life and going through certain things that it would give me what I needed to be able to do it and truly honor her. And that is my contribution. That is my gift. It's one of the proudest moments of my life, is to celebrate someone I've always admired. And I did it in a way that was so intentional, so honest, so authentic too. And it's just one of my greatest accomplishments that I got to tell her story properly.
And it is a gift, certainly to anybody who's a fan or you know, feels the way about her that many people do. My favorite, Tina, there's a lot of great performances of hers that I love. But I think it's a European tour where Bowie comes out and they do Tonight together, which I think Bowie wrote with Iggy Pop, maybe. I need to do my research, but I think they did. Anyway, he comes out, they perform it together live, and then they go into Let's Dance together. Mm. And their chemistry is just, and it doesn't even matter what existed off stage, but like their chemistry on stage. Yeah, there's not much else like it. Just,
I've studied her, of course, obviously her in her own right, but almost anyone you've seen her perform it with, you're going, look at the chemistry. Just really, just pay attention to it. And those other artists don't necessarily have that kind of chemistry with other people that they performed with. Saying that to say, Tina was and is, because she still exists in my life, is this, she became what the moment required. I mean, it was this cycle that was happening on stage. It wasn't the I, it's my turn to be up here and I'm going to show everyone that I'm Tina standing or singing next to this person. That's not what's happening. I'm sure she spent time with them to laugh. Something as simple as if we get each other's humor, we've had drinks, we've done that. By the time we get on stage, we're friends. We can tease each other. I'll run from you. You have to find me. What? Come here. What do you say in my ear? You cheeky boy. You that's been established. She understands what it takes for the moment that the rest of the world will see. She already planted the seeds months before. And that's what you then see on stage. And I just love that those kind of details.
Yeah. Knowing what the moment requires. I like that as a phrasing. Yes. And it's so eclectic, like from Olivia Newton-John, Tom Jones, Cher numerous times. Yes. Like so many, exactly what you describe it as, knowing what the moment requires.
Yes.
And she was described as, somebody else she performed with and around, the original Jagger. She taught Jagger to dance. So this is another kind of big transition moment for you here. You're starring in the West End, owning this role as Tina, but then a new opportunity presents itself. You get the opportunity to go and sing with the Rolling Stones, toe-to-toe with Jagger, like lead female vocals, the big numbers. How did that come to you? What happened?
I still laugh at myself because I would say the same thing. Like, how does this happen? When preparation meets opportunity, I was ready. I was full. I was whole. And when I got the call, can you send Mick Jagger footage of you right now playing Tina? Because they're about to do their show in Milan in 2 days. And we've suggested you, can you send it? And I'm so bad I called my friend. I said, can you get back over here and help me figure out how to send this? Sent it. And I went to sleep that night, woke up in the middle of the night, went to sleep, woke up. I couldn't sleep. But when the sun was up, I looked at my phone and I had almost 20 different emails from every department of, I call it the Rolling Stone planet, because it's another world. The doctors, the flight, everything, hairstylists, wardrobe, everything, road managers. The question was, can you be here in 48 hours? And do you know this song? Can you sing this song? We only need this one song because we can't do a show without doing this one song. And I said, of course, I'll be there. And again, even then I'm going, this, Tina, what did you do? How did you, because you gotta... Can't freak out. You don't have time to be afraid. Fear is an absolute waste of time. Quote me on that. It's a waste of time. You get out of your head and you know who you are. You've been waiting for that stage. You don't know how it's going to come, but when it's there, you know it. That's it. And I remember getting there and it was raining that day. So we couldn't even do a run through on the stage. So we had to sort of rehearse in the back, a made up room. And Mick was as close as you are to me.
Yeah,
and
I was just going to say, when you say we rehearsed, like who's the we?
It's me, Mick. Chuck Lavelle is standing between us, the music director, you know. Matt Clifford, who is, everyone knows, Mick's best friend, and he also piano there, and then Bernard, who is the head of BGs, of background vocals. So just making sure we're all matching and I know the structure of the song. Well, the way I was raised, rehearsal is like the show. I'm not going to be nice to you guys. I'm going to sing the skin off your face. So imagine I have to go straight into that note. There's no microphones, nothing, just this small room. And I'm screaming rape, murder directly into his face. And his face turned as red as yours right now. Because you can tell how intense it was, right?
Yeah.
It's just, and he had this smirk on his face. I could tell. It was just like this sweet pleasure. He was entertained. Like, this is so intense and so unexpected. And she just... And I'm sure they did a little research on like what I'd done with Tina. So he saw and knew my range. But I think they were really surprised to also feel she's not pretending. This show is going to be epic. So it kind of was, I remember catering and all the people and plates clinking. And they were like, what's going on in there? And the next thing was, oh, I should say, I had done five shows that week, so I was actually kind of hoarse. And I was very nervous that I wouldn't be able to hit those notes because those, I don't even know what key that song is in, but it was out there. And I knew I only had enough in the tank to do this song full out two times. One was in that little room, and I couldn't rehearse it anymore. I just went quiet. And the next was in front of 80,000 people. So I'm just as nervous as everybody else. And I'm like, once I heard Keith go, dong, 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 whatever, all the fear, everything melted away. And I just saw all the people as an army. This is the army. Keith is the general. Mick is the king who's going to come out and tell the army, there's a fire that's sweeping. And he makes this announcement to the army. I'm all this in my head. And I'm back there. Now it's my turn. He comes to me, extends his arm. And I say to myself, okay, queen, now you address the women and children. And I go, rape, murder. And I'm working that part. Then he comes, and now it's king and queen to the army. Here we are. And now it's all together. Like, I do these things in my head to be able to arrive. And later on, I told Mick that story. Because I said, do you wonder what I'm going to tell you a little secret, what goes on. He's like, he was so... Oh, I just love him. I love Keith. I love Ronnie. They've been so wonderful. They're the real deal. Sometimes you meet celebrities and you hope they're as good as you imagined they would be. You don't want to be disappointed. Well, I'm not disappointed.
You talk about them so flatteringly and sincerely, yeah. And you talk about that intense kind of pre-rehearsal scenario, but away from the singing, what was the experience of meeting them for the first time or your kind of introduction like? And clearly they took you into their bosom and made you feel welcome. But like, what was that kind of side of it? Like the kind of offstage aspect of, like you say, these... you know, worthy of the title, legendary artists of the genre.
I always prayed that I would find a family in entertainment. I've always been very blessed to have a good, in my real life, my personal life, a good family life. And I never could understand why can't I find that in my career. I'm just always being disappointed. I didn't know my family would be the Stones family. And like any family, there's some crazy, but that you already know this is the loopy one. You already know this is the one that's going to go make sure, like, hyper-vigilant. Like, you learn each other. And then you tease each other about it, which is, like, one of my favorite parts.
And that's how you know you're in. I think when people start, you know, taking the piss out of you, that's when you know, oh, we're in now. We're good.
Yeah. It's precious, you know, because, you know, they're in their 80s, right? They're not doing this for any other reason than because it is their own desire. It's I think, the most home that they feel is when they are together. It's the one thing that has survived almost everything in their life is those moments. That's the most consistent, precious, beautiful thing. And I feel everything, which is my curse and my strength, I guess. I don't know. I feel everything. So when I'm up there, I feel all those nuances. It's so sweet and beautiful. When Keith's back is to everyone, his expression, was it a tiny little expression? I know what it means if he's kind of like, it's so many details that I think I focus more on than probably what is seen.
Well, you have a unique perspective, and you're stepping into this incredible world, like you say, that is the only consistent in these incredible lives of these artists who still, like you say, despite their age and however many thousands of times they've performed, like, it still looks and feels fresh.
I'll tell you why it feels fresh. Because it's fresh to them on stage. And you wonder how in the world 60 plus years later is still that fresh. In my entire career, I have never experienced going on stage, and in sound check is when you learn what the playlist will be. You know there's going to be certain songs that are there, but almost every night, there is a change. And there's a song maybe that we haven't done in the entire first leg of the tour, but that's the one song we run through in soundcheck. And I remember thinking to myself, so everybody's okay with this? Like, this is a big show and we haven't done it. And so that particular song, maybe since rehearsal in LA like 2 months ago. So there is that surprise, fresh element for them every night. That is why it is felt, because there is no automatic up there. And sometimes there's a surprise guest. That surprise guest, sometimes I just thought to myself, I feel sorry for them because they finally get this opportunity. You know, they're like with the gods of rock and roll, and they turn into they can't take it. They're like, it's not even what they did in the rehearsal, because they can't believe the moment, you know? So that's going to be slightly different from what is expected on stage, because now the artist might be in their head instead of just going with the flow. But they, in that time, they take care of that megastar artist and kind of like, it's okay, you know?
At the end of this interview, I'm going to tag on, there's a great bit of concert footage where you and Mick are down the catwalk and you're going head to head. It's just a shot away. And he looks like he's enjoying your performance as much as his own and the event. Like, you can see the chemistry and you feeding off each other. And then you walk back down the catwalk to the band. And there's a great, the expressions on your faces and the way that you're embracing each other and holding each other. It's just one of those, it feels like a milestone moment. And I'll tag that onto the end of the interview because I think it's a really beautiful moment. They're still making new music, up until quite recently. Doesn't seem to be any sign in them slowing down.
Not to me.
I love that. Listen, we're getting close to the end of this epic interview, which has been as I knew it would be, phenomenal. We've got a few kind of standard questions that we like to drop in, okay, just for some kind of nuggets. What's the best bit of advice that you've never been given, i.e. something you had to learn yourself, but you're glad that you did?
I am so glad that I trusted myself. There is a lot of people that want, the same person even sometimes, I believe in you, you can do it. And that same person may come back and say, I don't know. And that becomes a roller coaster if you, you know, take that route. And actually, but for whatever reason, as a young child, I kind of always, even when those moments would happen, just go back to trusting. I keep pointing here because that's just where it is. I can just feel what's right. I would tell someone, do whatever, whether it's meditating or praying or being in nature, solitude, take that time to make sure you hear your voice, not someone else's expectations. But and when it's quiet, you'll hear that.
For listeners, anybody who's not watching the interview, Chanel keeps kind of gesticulating at her stomach, really, yeah, almost like your gut instinct,
yeah,
that deep feeling, mm-hmm, that sometimes you have to create clarity for, right? It, yeah, can, the world can get, life can get noisy and you can lose, mm-hmm, that. And I think that's a great link to the solitude that you mentioned. Sometimes you need a vacuum to kind of be, all right, let's reset.
Yes.
Let's hone in on my feelings. Sticking with your senses, we've come to your senses. What are kind of five recommendations or ways in which you like to nourish your soul in terms of tastes, sounds, sights, smells, touches? Mm.
Sounds, I listen to a lot of audio around Carl Jung. I'm a huge fan. Whenever I kind of get too distracted in my head, I'll listen to some of my favorite philosophers, psychiatrists. he's my favorite. Things, you said senses, like things.
Yeah, like it is, well, from a sight perspective.
The ocean. Sitting at the foot of the ocean, the sound of the waves, the vision, not being able to see the end, and knowing that every single wave that comes, there's nothing like it before or after, makes me feel very present and alive. That's kind of a seeing, hearing, smell. All the senses is probably my favorite place ever, is to have be at the foot of, at the sea.
I like that. In terms of the industry, it is ever-changing, evolving interests, new types of performances, mm-hmm, new arenas to perform in. How do you see it changing at the moment, and how would you change it given the chance?
Oh, my goodness. First of all, I think the best change ever is by being the change you want to see in the world. So I can't stress authenticity. It is your superpower. So if you want to see change, be that change. I know that might sound like, whatever, that's not, but it really is that simple, because no one can do or be what you are in that moment. So if the Stones need one girl, one, and I am the one chosen because I didn't necessarily follow all the, I broke a rule. I said, I'm not doing this show. I'm doing that show, because rules, they have their place. But I also know that if they were created, I didn't create it. So I might like it or I might not like it. If it doesn't serve me, I probably will break it. How it is.
I think that's a really healthy relationship to have with rules, which are always something that somebody else created.
Yeah.
There was a time they didn't exist.
Exactly.
And for sure, there's some that we are wise to stick to, but there's also some that you shouldn't be afraid to break.
Use your common sense.
Yeah. Listen, one of my standard questions is going to be, if you gave up performing today, what would you go and do tomorrow? But you've already kind of clarified. Singing or nothing, I think.
Well, you know, I would say a very close CIA or FBI agent type person. I really enjoy, and it does play a lot into what I do. I love studying human behavior, seeing how all the choices made to be exactly where you are, being able to detect what's authentic and when someone is not who they say they are, and coming to the truth of it. My poor son, this last night, I went into his room and I said, oh, the window is too high. You should pull it down because I don't want you to get a cold. It's too cold. And I went to my bedroom. I put him down. I go in my room and I don't know why my first thought in the morning was, I wonder if he lifted that window. And I just went in his room and I saw, and something in me was like, he immediately just, and so I went to his room. I said, good morning. He's like, good morning, mommy. Said, looks like you lifted that window, even though why would I care about that detail? But those kind of things, I don't know. It's interesting.
You're surrounded by some interesting characters to have an interest in psychology. Here's one.
Yeah.
What do you want people to say about you when you're not in the room?
If anything, I think it would just have something to do with wherever I see Chanel. It could be on stage or at her house or in a restaurant or in a club. She's the same person. And that's probably their favorite thing, is because you're never surprised with, because some people, it's like, oh my gosh, she's so different when she's whatever.
Versions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I am not that person. I think, and there's absolutely a freedom in that. And I would wish anyone who spent any significant amount of time with me would see that and appreciate that about me, that what you see is what you get. And with great care and love, I'm not around at all.
Do you know what I'm struck by? Because you are a force of nature. I mean that in the most admiring and affectionate way. You are a force of nature, but you're also a very gentle and soulful character as well. I always feel so calm in your presence, which is why you're sat here as the first guest on the show. The authenticity, for sure, that I wherever I've met you or spoke to you.
We're like this.
Yeah. Okay. Final kind of big question, really. If Chanel was looking down on you now, what advice from the heart would she give you?
She would say, there's this one precious life that you have. There's so much still yet for you to learn. Everything that I experience, whether it's the good, the bad, the ugly, betrayal, it could be a beautiful surprise, it could be a love, it could be anything. They all serve you to make you the best version of yourself. So there's no need to be afraid or in fear, but to every single day embrace the life, this precious life I've been given. Appreciate the health that you have. Appreciate the loves in your life. Appreciate that you get to do what you love to do every single day of your life. And whatever comes, it all works to continue to cultivate you, serving you, making you the most beautiful version of yourself, because that's the goal. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I'm so grateful for you coming to do this, particularly today when it was a schlep to get here.
Oh, I'm happy to be here with you.
Last question.
Yeah.
Who should I interview next?
Oh, woo-woo. I mean, that I just thought of another friend, like Ben Water. I don't know if you know of him. He's just an incredible pianist that I've met while I was here. And he plays almost like, you know, not almost like, but it's Fats Domino in the 50s. And he's Blueberry Hill, all that stuff. It's just a rare, unique beauty. Okay, but then the other person I'm thinking of, let me see, hold on.
You know what you reminded me of while you were saying that? And I knew there would be so much stuff that we wouldn't touch because of time. Ooh, ooh. But you were somewhere on tour and I'm sure you met John Baptiste.
Oh, yes. Beautiful soul. This man, I mean, he went to basically the brother school of my school. So I went to St. Mary's Academy High School. He went to St. Augustine Catholic All Boys
I didn't
school.
Realize that.
Yeah. And it's sort of this thing that we're always, you know, we go to each other's dances and like, oh, I go, my girlfriend is a St. Mary's girl and my boyfriend is a saint. Anyway, we've never met each other. And I think he may be a year or two ahead of me. I mean, we're close in age, but it was on tour that he's opening for the Stones. I think it was the New York show,
right.
I think. And they were all on stage. And normally when it's time for everyone else to prep, you know, we're backstage doing makeup, relaxing, whatever. Whoever's performing, we can hear them, but we don't necessarily come out because you want to take all your time to get ready for the show. Not this day. I said, my homeboy is here. So I went up and I stayed out and I watched the whole show. We prayed together in this big circle. And then I never really used my phone to take videos and pictures of celebrities because it's kind of cheesy, but I knew he would understand the moment. So I said, asked if it was okay. And we videoed each other and sort of like from backstage. So I showed the two of us and then I showed the stadium and I was like, look at us. And he was like, yeah, our New Orleans accent, you know, it was just really sweet. I was very happy to be with him, to see him in his glory, because he is exceptional. And if you interviewed him, I promise you it would almost be energetically, like vibe wise almost identical to this interview.
All right, well, fingers crossed. And I'll let you know.
Yeah, because, I mean, if I could choose anybody, I'd say, yeah, my homeboy, John. But yeah, he's a wonderful soul.
He's at the height of his powers, isn't he? He is a master of his craft just a really beautiful artist.
He is. And he has such great respect for his craft and for the people around him. And seeing his circle, the people that are in his most intimate circle, which tells you everything you need to know, really, especially on tour when you're traveling the world. I mean, they were just lovely. And yeah, I don't know how that would actually come about, but if I had anything to do with it, I would try to figure out how to get John Baptiste. He'd be the best. But I'll think of some others too. Yeah.
All right. You've got to go to America in a few days.
I do.
I'm so grateful that you came and did this with us. I really, really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
We've been getting notes from Chanel Haynes. Chanel, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Shep.
Benito.